Thank you, Terry. Let me start with an assumption and an invitation. First, the assumption. Whether in the lab or in the field, designing or running a controlled experiment, sooner or later, scientists and engineers will contribute to some, perhaps many, innovations, or at least innovating efforts. Now, if there's any truth to this, then it behooves scientists and engineers to have a working understanding of what innovating is and is not, and what it takes to be effective contributors, innovators, if you will. That's the assumption. If that assumption is incorrect and you disagree with it, then you might want to go to another session. You have my permission, and I won't be offended. Here's the invitation. The invitation is to consider both innovating and faith. I'll say it again. I'm inviting you to consider both innovating and faith, and especially the intersection between the two, because I believe this intersection is largely ignored and poorly understood. So I need to describe both streets, innovating first, then faith, and then we'll talk about the intersection of when they come together. So innovation has received a lot of press recently. In all the press, there's been some signal, awful lot of noise. So let me offer what I consider to be a balanced and non-controversial view of innovating. My viewpoint is biased towards innovation, viewing innovation more as a verb rather than a noun or an adjective. Given my background as a facilitator and a midwife, it's one of a word my client, one of my clients invented, for corporate innovating as opposed to entrepreneurial, some people call it intrapreneurial, work. Hence, I prefer the word innovating. I don't mean to irritate you, but I prefer that. I feel more comfortable speaking out of that context than innovation. So innovating, let me define it, is a collaborative effort to work through five essential task-driven states. An effort that does not involve all five is not likely an innovating effort, except, of course, for aborted attempts at innovating, and there are plenty of those. The five essential states are these. One, discovering a need. Two, inventing a solution. Three, reducing the solution to practice, as patent attorneys like to call it, or simply, the more vernacular, making the solution work for everyone, not only the end user, but to produce it at scale and at a profit that is interesting to the company producing it. Four, introducing the new solution, a master introducer we just lost, Stephen Jobs, and integrating or finding a home for the new solution in the life of the end user. My premise is this, that the faith of innovators is operating in and between each of these states, albeit in different faith patterns for each state, and in state-specific atmospheres of fear. Why should this premise be of interest? Well, if scientists and engineers want to contribute even more effectively to innovating, then understanding faith and learning what faith pattern is appropriate to each state of innovating will make scientists and engineers more effective contributors. So here are the faith patterns that I'd like to express as pairs of statements and their corresponding states and the respective fears. First is awe and wonder. Awe and wonder is essential for discovering needs against the fear of unlearning. Inspiration and appreciation are useful for inventing solutions against the fear of rejection. Forgiveness and persistence for reducing the solution to practice against the fear of failure. Submission and humility for introducing the innovation against the fear of loss. And gratitude and acceptance for integration against the fear of success. Time will only allow us to look at awe and wonder, but before we do, we need to take another look at how we typically understand what we call faith. I think our understanding of this thing we call faith is too narrow and too small. Over the past 30 years, I've been fortunate enough to have collaborated with scientists and engineers engaged in struggles of innovating, struggles that are rarely noticed except by innovators themselves. These struggles are seldom written about. Increasingly, over the past three decades, I've come to believe that what distinguishes innovators is not where they were born, not how they were educated, not even the domains that they live in, although that's a heavy influence, but how they overcome these struggles. Increasingly, I've come to believe that the way they overcome these struggles is by their faith deployed. I've come to believe that that's the defining characteristic of the innovators we heard about in this morning's talk. They deploy their faith repeatedly. When I started working in R&D organizations back in the 1980s, I noticed a strangely familiar pattern. Scientists and engineers, when innovating solutions and developing new products and processes, were behaving in ways that I had studied and preached about as a Presbyterian pastor. The only difference was that they were rarely talking about it. And on the rare occasion when they did talk about it, they certainly did not use religious or doctrinal language. Yet the patterns of their behavior and thought were strikingly similar to the patterns of faith embedded in the narrative, prose, and poetry of the Old and New Testaments. As I paid closer attention to these patterns, I began to see faith in action. Now, by faith, I do not mean a believing this or that kind of faith, a propositional faith. It is really more a believing in. I'm not talking about a religious faith per se. It's not an affirmation of doctrine or creed, but it is faith nonetheless. The same faith that Jesus referred to as a mustard seed, one that can move mountains. The same faith that Jesus said after all the healing miracles in the Synoptic Gospels, your faith has made you well. The same faith Jesus recognized in the Roman centurion, not a believer the way we would talk about him, but a believer nonetheless. In all Israel, Jesus said, I have never seen such faith. I believe Jesus assumed that everyone, Jew, Gentile, centurion, disciple, sinner, saint, has at least a nano seed of faith in them. And many of us just don't use it very often, or as much as we can and should. And all of us have it and can access it like a muscle. Faith gets stronger when it's used, when it's stretched, flexed, exercised. Think of faith as something akin to potential energy. It is a term coined by the 19th century Scottish physicist and engineer William Rankine. Potential energy is the energy stored within any physical system. Rankine called it potential energy because it holds potential to be converted into other various forms of energy to do work. For example, the energy a coil spring holds when it is compressed or stretched is potential energy. When the pressure is released, the stored energy is converted into kinetic energy. The spring snaps back and noticeable force and movement as it returns to its resting state shows us the energy that it's there. According to the principle of conservation of energy, energy cannot be destroyed or created, hence the energy cannot disappear. Instead, it is stored as potential energy. Now, human beings, as physical systems, also have potential energy, I'm proposing. We use it in various ways, but it doesn't show up unless and until it is activated or converted. When it is, then we can sense it. The more we use our faith, the stronger it becomes. Innovators tend to be heavy users of their faith, and as a result, they tend to appear to have more faith than most. So, I'm obviously offering a slightly different way of thinking about faith with the following model. Think of faith as playing out in at least four different dimensions: the social, the emotional, the vocational, and the rational. When we mistakenly confine faith to only one of these, or even two of these dimensions, or worse, relegate its relevance only for religious or spiritual matters, We underestimate its potential and unnecessarily divorce ourselves from its animating and creative force. In social context, we call faith trust. In emotional contexts, we call faith confidence. In vocational context, faith shows up as hope, and in rational context, we think of it as belief. Faith is potential energy residing in the human system, waiting to be released in concrete action. What does the faith muscle look like in its more active state? Well, when expending energy and put to work, faith builds muscle mass in each of these four dimensions. When exercised, faith expands like a muscle in each of these dimensions. When there is sufficient trust between and among participants, the commitment to do something becomes possible. When enough confidence builds up, we are encouraged or able to encourage others to do the next right thing. With sufficient hope, faith morphs into engaged and focused minds and hearts that become immersed in what needs to be done. And when belief becomes conviction, our minds can envision where our intentions lead us. In order to work properly, faith requires a source of energy. Love is this energy source. Love activates, animates, and sustains faith. Love provides energy for trust to expand into commitment, for confidence to become courage, for hope to be turned into engagement, for belief to become vision. Without love, faith remains nothing more than potential. With the fuel of love, faith comes alive and works. We take action. So our model of faith would be and remain incomplete without the placement of love at the heart and center of faith. Perfect love, by the way, casts out fear. And fear is the enemy of innovating. It's silent killer. As a pattern of faith, awe and wonder is... So let's look at awe and wonder, the first of these five patterns of faith that innovators use in their innovating. This faith pattern is not limited to the discovery task or state. However, for this state, it is absolutely essential. Now, as a pattern of faith, awe and wonder is a way of sensing and perceiving. It also shows up, as you might imagine, in a variety of different biblical places. The Psalms, Isaiah, and of course, the familiar story of Moses and the burning bush. Now, in this story, the faith pattern of awe and wonder is wonderfully embedded in just a few verses, so I use it as our sample. It provides us a useful window into what the pattern of faith actually is. Here's the story translated in the NRSV. Moses, you'll remember this story, was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness. Interesting context. How can you get beyond the wilderness? And came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire. What other kind of flame is there? A flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. And then Moses said to himself, or the sheep, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Moses was beyond the wilderness. How often in your domains, how recently, each of you have taken yourselves beyond the wilderness. Where Moses was beyond the wilderness and what he did when he saw there this strange anomaly reveals a pattern that I have seen many scientists and engineers unconsciously enact in a variety of different R&D settings. The pattern or sequence is the following. In short, first, there is a turning aside to look. Second, there is an asking of why. Third, there is a call that is heard or felt. And fourth, there is a need discovered. These four elements, it turns out, comprise awe and wonder and are absolutely essential for innovating. So let's take a closer look at each one. First, turning aside. The more experience we have, and there's a fair amount of experience in this room, just by the gray hairs, the more difficult it is to simply turn aside and look. Our experience in a particular field reinforces the assumption and our own identity in that field that we know what is relevant and what is not. Specialization can leave innovators, often specialists themselves, partially blind to the possibilities outside their own domain. Thomas Kuhn, in his classic Structure of Scientific Revolution, described this very dilemma for experts. When new evidence, which is not quite called a fact yet, emerges outside the prevailing wisdom, it often goes unrecognized, dismissed, even denied. Entire companies do something similar. Clayton Christensen points out what many of us had recognized for years before, how denial can affect incumbents and market share leaders. Momentum and mindset prevent incumbents from seeing what is there. The disruptive technology, a fashionable word these days, doesn't suddenly appear as disruptive. In fact, it usually has been on the competitive horizon for years. When it appears, it typically is regarded as too small, too costly, too niche-y to worry about. Moses, on the other hand, was very deliberate about this step. He tells himself, the narrator says, that one must look aside, and Moses even tells himself, I must turn aside to look. It's almost like I've got to stop doing what I'm doing. It's difficult. The second element is asking why. Moses not only tells himself, I must turn aside and look, he goes on to say, to see why this bush is not burned up. What Moses saw was not simply a shrub, he saw something more, a mystery, something unexpected, evidence of things unseen. And he asked why. Like Moses, innovators, at least in my experience, can't help but turn aside to look and seek some explanation for, thank you, turn aside to seek some explanation for the why. This is the beginning of the process of discovery, a beginning that both the scientific method and innovating share. Discovery requires examining both the emerging system and the ecosystems from which it is emerging. Toyota, the most advanced development culture in the world, the most reliable innovating system in the world, they have a practice they call asking the five whys. It's the fifth why that will tell you something meaningful, not the first four. Margaret Wheatley, in her book Leadership and the New Science, puts it this way, learning to observe the whole of a system is difficult. Our traditional analytical skills can't help us. Analysis narrows our field of awareness and actually prevents us from seeing the total system. Or as Hans-Peter Dürr, former director of Max Planck Institute, once remarked, there is no analytical language to describe what we are seeing at the quantum level. I can only say that it does not help to analyze things in more detail. The more specific the information, the less relevant it is. What happens next to Moses brings us to the third element of awe and wonder, hearing a call. The story says this, when the Lord saw Moses had turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush. And we know that that call changed his life. Innovators are seldom credentialed or trained as innovators, although many schools, like this one, will tell you they've established a school for entrepreneurs. Instead, their vocation, like Moses, emerges out of whatever it is that has captured their attention, their own burning bushes. Innovation and innovator emerge together out of a discovery of what is needed. which we learn a few short verses later was the misery of my people. The point is that there is often vocation in what might appear simple curiosity. This brings us to the fourth element and final element, discovering the need. Not unlike the direct communication between Moses and God, where there is awe and wonder in our attention, there, I believe, we will find a need worth addressing. This is one reason I suspect that the late father of modern management theory, Peter Drucker, called innovating a diagnostic discipline. Drucker went on to say something that has been roundly ignored by those who write about innovating, that innovation is not based on the bright idea. That is the least reliable source of innovation. Rather, it is to be found in the surprise, success, or failure within the context of your own immediate experience. It is right under your nose, in other words. But we will not see it without awe and wonder. So awe and wonder, turn aside and look, ask why, hear the call, discover the need. We need more of this, don't you think? The prophet Isaiah said long ago, this about our habitual tendency to neglect awe and wonder in the mundane. Isaiah said, "You shall indeed hear, but never understand. And you shall indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown fat, and their eyes are heavy with hearing, and their ears are heavy with hearing, and their eyes have closed." An abundance comes to us of information every day. We seem to hear but do not understand. We seem to perceive, but we do not. We seem to see but we do not perceive. Can we get better at seeing compelling opportunities for innovating, or have our hearts grown fat? Compelling opportunities are sitting there waiting for us to discover them. What is missing? All it takes, at least initially, is a little faith, potential energy, for awe and wonder to carry us through to the next step. And if we take the next step, we just may find that we are standing on holy ground. Thank you. Excellent question. I don't know, that's a cultural analysis. I'd point you to a book by Hudson. I think his name's Hudson. I'm forgetting it, but I can look it up. Who's basically said that the church has lost its voice in North America because of its alliance with the voice of power rather than grace and truth. An example he points to is the religious right. And so this culture around us is no longer listening to the church. It's irrelevant, indifferent. Bruce talked about that this morning. Your point about, Jews versus evangelical Christians, I think is a great one. I haven't thought about that, and I think it's a great question. I'll have to think about it. I don't know. What do you think? In I think the fifth or sixth chapter of my book, I talk about the difference between expectations and hope, and if you can have an expectationless hope, that's hope. Purified. Yeah, theologically, I can give a whack. Jesus, wasn't a Christian. I just read a book by Loch Fink, German, just was translated, called Jesus. It's one of the best books on Jesus through the Gospels. Very, takes advantage of all the biblical scholarship. He said that Jesus was really interested in the people of God and the particular mission that Israel had. And to the extent that the church has that mission, then I might theologically, I've been thinking about this now for 2 minutes, play back to you that maybe one of the reasons that it hasn't, there hasn't been as strong a voice or presence is that evangelical Christians may be too identifying themselves too much with that identity and maybe need to broaden themselves, to see themselves as the people of God with other people of God. Center set theory rather than boundary set theory. Sorry, it's just speculation. Yeah, and there's great prophetic voice coming to the church, I think, in North America to get out of its box. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.